Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Dry Dock episode 402. This week, the questions are taken from guides 469 and 470 on the UC type U-boats and USS New Ironsides, the Wednesday videos on Mikasa and plunging naval gunnery fire, and the Friday video on where the US fleet happened to be on December 7th, 1941. Martin Swinney asks, I just had a thought. I wonder if anyone has tried reverse depth charges, i.e. some kind of explosive mounted atop a submarine to be released under a ship and then float up with a detonator that was set to go off at shallow depths under the ship or possibly on contact with the hull. Not really a decent offensive weapon, but in case of being chased by destroyers, maybe? I'm sure it was thought about at various points. However, there are two rather major problems with the idea, which would be why it wasn't really implemented. Firstly, you would be storing the equivalent of a depth charge on the outside of the sub. Now, in theory, okay, you might be able to store it between the pressure hull and the casing so you don't get a bunch of drag, perhaps with a launch hatch or something, but you're still storing a considerable amount of explosive in what has to be a fairly lightly built device, because it's got to be very buoyant, sitting in salt water for weeks on end, which is probably going to degrade its functionality. Plus, of course, it means you have a bunch of barely contained explosive on the outside of the sub, which means if you get depth charge before you can counter undepth charge the escort, there is a non-zero chance that the explosive effects or the shockwaves of the depth charges going on around you at best are going to collapse this thing and make it unusable, and at worst possibly even set it off. The other problem is, how fast can the thing rise? Because of course depth charges sink, they're negatively buoyant. Your reverse depth charge would have to be fairly positively buoyant, and even fairly positively buoyant objects don't actually accelerate upwards through the water or travel at particularly high speeds, because water is quite resistant. If you were down at, say, 200 feet, and bear in mind, obviously, you've got to be deep enough to be clear of the explosive effect yourself, it's going to take a few minutes, probably, for the thing to actually reach the surface. So you'd either be talking about a very large device to have enough air to be buoyant while carrying a significant explosive charge, or a device about the size of your average depth charge would carry a fairly weak explosive, which obviously may not actually harm the ship that you're attacking. And all of that, of course, assumes that you can predict, based on your depth, how fast the thing is going to rise, and based on where the enemy ship is and where you are at that point, you know, if you release it, is it actually going to come up somewhere near the enemy vessel? Bear in mind, most enemy vessels are going to be faster on the surface than you are submerged, so if you release such a thing, your release is going to depend entirely on the enemy. So you'd have to be running dead ahead of the enemy vessel. You'd have to be further ahead than the time it takes to rise, and you'd have to time it. So you'd have to be going, okay, well, the enemy is closing on us at a closing speed of, I don't know, let's say 4 knots, for sake of example. And then you'd have to go, okay, and now is when we have to release it. So essentially it'd be a very, very, very niche use case weapon with all sorts of downsides and a lot of problems to it. So it's just better to try and evade at that point. Almirante Brown asks, Drac, what are your thoughts about the utility of a submarine specifically designed to attack merchant shipping with large numbers of 18-inch torpedoes like the Italian Cagni class? Could this type of submarine complement smaller submarines that were armed with 21-inch torpedoes? I think an alpha strike of 8 or more pattern-running torpedoes, if stern tubes are included, could potentially devastate a convoy. I think this kind of submarine really depends on who exactly is building it and who exactly their intended targets are. So for the Italians, for example, I don't think the Cagni class was a brilliant investiture of resources, mostly because the situation where I think you would need such a submarine is one where your target, or target nation, I suppose, has lots and lots of merchant ships. Okay, they're at war with Britain. Britain has lots of merchant ships. Great. However, you would also need your target to or your target areas, I should say, to be quite a considerable distance from your base, your submarine would need to be quite large, and therefore the operating conditions would need to favour a large submarine. And that, I think, is where the Cagney Glass fall down for the Italians, because occasionally they prove quite useful against Allied shipping, but the Mediterranean, although it does have its deep parts, is generally a relatively small, confined, shallow area of operations relative to places like the Pacific and the Atlantic. And so one of the advantages of having a submarine with lots and lots of 18-inch torpedoes is you can be out for a long time before needing to reload. Well, in the Mediterranean, that's less of an issue. You can go home to Italy and reload torpedoes if you need to. It's not as difficult as, say, if you're a Type 7 or a Type 9 stuck in the middle of the Atlantic and you have to try and somehow early in the war get back to Germany and later in the war get back to France. And I also mentioned, obviously, you need a big sub, and that's because you're only talking about a 3-inch diameter difference in the torpedoes. On a small sub, something that displaces 600-800 tons or so, it's not going to make a vast difference to either the number of torpedoes you can carry or the number of torpedo tubes you can carry. Yes, you can carry a slightly greater number, possibly, but it's not really going to make a huge difference to have, oh, we can have a couple more torpedoes in here. Whereas if you build a big submarine, thanks to the square cube law, then suddenly you can do rather ridiculous things like the Cagneys, as you can see here, 8 internal torpedo tubes up front, 6 at the back, 3 dozen torpedoes total. You know, the Cagney class, as a 1,600 plus ton on the surface submarine, was about the right size for a long distance, purely commerce raiding small torpedo launching submarine, although of course against a big target you can just fire lots of small torpedoes. But realistically, the Mediterranean was not the right operating environment for them. So you can probably see where this is leading. For the Germans, something like the Cagney class would make sense, because, you know, they had to develop Milchow type U-boats to go and resupply other U-boats at sea with things including torpedoes. If they'd had something like a Cagney class, it's big, it's long range, it can therefore carry lots of stores, and it can carry tons of torpedoes, so it can go out and, you know, realistically, it's going to be out of fuel before it's going to be out of torpedoes in most cases. Plus, you know, 8 torpedoes straight into a convoy, that's going to be pretty nasty. I mean, you kind of have the weird thing of, in some ways, the Italians developing several submarine types the Germans could have used really well, and the Germans developing a few submarine types the Italians could have used really well, and they just ended up in the wrong operational environments. For the British, though, there's no point, because no one they're going after really has a substantial merchant fleet apart from Japan, and, well, British submarines don't operate against the Japanese all that much until near the end of the war, by which point the US submarine fleet has exterminated much of the Japanese merchant fleet. In pre-war planning for fighting Japan, something like the Cagney class based in Singapore for the Royal Navy would have made sense, but it would have been a very niche, this only makes sense in this particular combat environment, and not as part of their general strategy, whereas for the Germans it makes more sense. For the Japanese, actually, a Cagney class doesn't make much sense, because while America does have a large merchant fleet, there's just not any significant trade lanes for the Japanese to meaningfully attack. And when you do get ships that are like merchant ships, so cargo ships, transport ships, etc., they tend to be surrounded by a lot of angry escorts, at which point you probably want your bigger torpedoes to try and deal with them. But for the US Navy, retrospectively, something like a Cagney class would make sense because, well, it's big like a fleet boat, and whereas a fleet boat obviously is somewhat better for hunting warships because it's got a fair number of torpedoes and they're big and it's quite swift on the surface, the fleet boat makes a lot of sense for US pre-war planning. But the way World War II actually worked out for the US submarine fleet, I would argue that if they had a fleet boat variant that was more like the Cagney class, they might actually have wiped out the Japanese merchant fleet even faster, because an awful lot of Japanese escort ships for their convoys were pretty small, and an 18-inch torpedo probably would have done for them just as much as a 21-inch did. And, you know, torpedoes not working in the early part of the campaign aside, very often US fleet subs were forced to return because they had run out of torpedoes or were close to running out of torpedoes, more so than they necessarily run out of targets or endurance. So some fleet boat variant with a whole ton of 18-inch torpedoes might have been able to score even more kills. BK Zhang asks, in World War II, submarine crews tended to have the highest casualty figures across most navies. Was this also the case in World War I? Yes, it still was very much the case. Slightly less so, though. Although that would be fairly cold comfort if you were a U-boat crew, for example. So if you go by purely number of U-boats in commission and commissioned during the respective wars versus number of U-boats lost, it's slightly safer to be a U-boat crewman in World War I because they, quote-unquote, only have a hull loss rate of about 62% versus a hull loss rate of about 68 to 69% in World War II. However, the number for World War II is skewed downwards somewhat in that analysis by the fact that, thanks to the mass production that Germany gets into in the latter stages of World War II, they have a huge number of, relatively speaking, huge number of U-boat hulls that are commissioned in the last few months of the Second World War and either do just one patrol or don't actually do any patrols before the war is over. And obviously, therefore, aren't sunk. There's a whole bunch that are scuttled and surrendered. And if you try and take those out, then the loss rate of U-boats in World War II climbs into kind of the mid-70s percentage-wise. So it becomes not just more dangerous, but considerably more dangerous to be a U-boat crewman in World War II compared to World War I. But, you know, still a 62% loss rate is not something that is good in any way, shape or form. And the same is true in pretty much all the other navies. You know, submarines are a very dangerous thing to be in wartime, certainly in World War I and World War II. And although the crews generally are obviously somewhat smaller, if they're lost in active combat, there is a very high chance of them being lost with all hands. Because, of course, if your pressure hull collapses when you're several hundred feet underwater, there's a fairly high chance none of you are coming back. Of course, some submarines do survive, the crews do, at least in part, when they're able to surface or they sink in shallow water or they're sunk by not a depth charge and things like this. But still, the percentage of crew lost is also very, very high. For the Royal Navy, for example, again, in World War I, it's somewhat safer than it is in World War II. But compared to the Germans, A, Royal Navy submarine losses proportional to their fleet are just generally lower anyway. But it also is highly dependent with the Royal Navy on which class of submarine you happen to be in, because the average loss rates for Royal Navy submarine classes in both World War I and World War II seem to be either around 25 to 30% or 45 to 50%, depending on the class. And of course, therefore, you can work out the average is going to be probably somewhere in the high 30s, low 40s, which is about half the loss rate or less of that of the German U-boats. But you do have some extreme outliers. So you will have some classes that suffer minimal to no losses in either war, and you'll have some classes which suffer near total wipeout in both wars. Particularly in the Second World War, there are some small batch runs of interwar class subs, which in some cases there's only one left by the end of the war, even though, as I said, there aren't any complete class wipeouts. But then on the other hand, you'll have very large batch runs of, say, war-built S-class, so the pre-war S-class subs. They suffer something like two-thirds casualties, whereas the war-built S-class, their loss rate is actually considerably lower. Mitch M. asks, the iron shutters over New Ironside's gun ports are a style I don't think I've ever seen before. Was that kind of hinged scissor style common? And why use it instead of the more traditional horizontal or vertical outward opening shutters? This kind of opening, as you can see here, it wasn't actually that common. Now, it was an attempt to solve a rather interesting problem that came about with, of course, the advent of ironclads, which was, as long as you were going to have broadside gun ports or really gun ports of any significant kind where the gun ran back in inside either a hull and in some cases a turret, but most usually the hull, that opening was a weakness. Now, back in the Age of Sail, of course, you had a nice, usually upward opening wooden gun port, but that was mostly there just to keep the water out when the ship wasn't in combat. It didn't serve any real protective purpose in battle. The only exception to that was purpose-built fireships whose gun ports hinged downwards, because it meant when you set them on fire, the gun ports would open when the ropes burned through and then guns would go off. But nonetheless, during the Ironclad era, however, you had to armor these things, because otherwise, again, weakness in otherwise a fairly substantial amount of protection. And that made them heavy, on top of the fact, of course, as guns got bigger, they were physically getting bigger anyway. And so various solutions were tried for this. Apart from the sheer weight, the other problem was, of course, if you went with a traditional big square gun port, if you were trying to open it as one whole unit, then thanks to physics, the moment of force and therefore how much effort you had to put into actually, you know, lifting the thing would get substantially larger if it was, you know, 4, 5, 6 foot long compared to if it was somewhat smaller. So on New Ironsides, they went with this scissor idea where you had two halves on axles and then you would have to use ropes to open them, as you can see here, kind of sideways. There were some problems with this. They didn't jam as often as you'd think, but they did have the possibility of being jammed quite a lot more than other methods. Partly because if they got hit, assuming they didn't just crack, they were obviously then flush with the armor. So if they dented and the armor underneath them dented, you now had a divot that was holding them in place. Also, as you can probably tell, they're constantly fighting against gravity. So if anything hits them and severs the ropes or chains that are holding them open, they are going to slam shut, which is going to be a bit of a problem if you want to keep using your guns. The much more common method that was arrived at for various navies for their gun port lids was actually like this, to split them in half, but to have the split horizontally rather than vertically. And so you ended up with two short half lids, one of which was very easy to open. You just poke it and it opens downwards, presumably with a big slam. That's nice and easy. And the other half, obviously, you would have to open upwards like a conventional gun port. But of course, it being a lot smaller and not protruding as much, it didn't take as much effort as a full single gun port would to elevate. Now, of course, yes, that upper gun port was also fighting against gravity and could in theory be severed, but it was much easier to lock off. The vulnerable area was smaller, as you can probably surmise looking at the area covered by these scissor gun ports when they're open. And ultimately, if half a gun port fell down and was blocking half of your access to the outside world for a gun, you could haul the gun forward and the barrel, acting kind of like a little battering ram, could just push it open enough to poke the barrel beyond it. Whereas with these things, they were falling sideways. You could poke it as much as you liked with the gun. It wasn't going to be moving anywhere. Next up, we have the question. I want to say the combat debut of Palliser armor-piercing shot was at the Battle of Angamos during the War of the Pacific, where a pair of Chilean central battery ironclads battered the Peruvian Monitor Huascar into submission. Do you know if the Chileans used Palliser shot, shell, or both in that action? And did the Chileans allow Royal Navy personnel to assess the damage to Huascar after the battle to determine the efficacy of Palliser ammunition? And what changes were made to the design of the ammunition based on its performance at Angamos? As far as I'm aware, the Chileans were using pretty much entirely Palliser shot, although, as you can see here, even the shot did have an explosive component to it, and certainly the Palliser shell wouldn't have been capable of doing the kind of penetrating damage to Huascar that was observed. In terms of allowing Royal Navy personnel to assess the damage to Huascar after the battle, that I'm not entirely clear on. I do need to do a bit more reading on the War of the Pacific. However, it should be mentioned that an awful lot of Chile's naval officer corps was trained by the Royal Navy, and there were a fair number of ex-Royal Navy officers serving in the Chilean Navy at the time, although what value of ex-Royal Navy those particular officers were on a case-by-case basis, of course, could vary. Some of them were genuinely, I've retired from the Royal Navy, but I'm now serving with this Navy. Others were kind of doing more of a sabbatical, which was common for Royal Navy officers in the 19th century. But in terms of changes made to the Palliser ammunition, there weren't all that many changes, to be perfectly honest, because Palliser shot had gone through a fair number of revisions in the early 1870s after some gunnery exercises showed that the initial batches of Palliser shot had this annoying habit of flying apart like gigantic shotgun shells when you fired them. But by the late 1870s, by the time of the Battle of Angamos, Palliser shot had to a certain extent been superseded because further tests during the 1870s had shown that the newly incoming compound plate armour, which had steel over iron, was actually quite effective at defeating Palliser shot, which was itself iron. And therefore, the latest and greatest in shell design had moved on. So to penetrate compound armour, you would need shells that had at least a steel head, if not made entirely of steel. And so, whilst Palliser shot, and to a certain extent Palliser shell, although much less commonly, did remain in active service for a considerable time after the late 1870s, that would be because, well, there were a lot of older guns afloat, and Palliser shot was about the best you were going to get to use in those. And, of course, just because the latest and greatest in compound and later early steel armour could defeat Palliser shot quite well, it didn't mean that there weren't a ton of older iron-armoured ships still around, against which Palliser shell would still be pretty effective. But with iron-armoured ships, and therefore the ammunition needed to defeat them, kind of having been frozen by the advent of the compound and then the steel-armoured vessels, the revisions to Palliser ammunition in the 1880s, following the Battle of Angamos, didn't really amount to all that much. Zepp Flyer asks, you mentioned a heavy wooden bulkhead installed in new Ironsides. Why were these never installed in Age of Sail warships when such a deal was made of stern raking fire? Why was a thick bulkhead never installed perhaps forward of the captain's cabin or further forward to at least limit damage? Essentially because on new Ironsides, although the bulkhead was mostly, in terms of thickness, made of wood, it did have iron plating on the exterior side, the stern-facing side, so it did have some protective value. Now, would it have stopped a 68-pounder solid shot? No. It was nowhere near thick enough for that. But it was thick enough to stop explosive shells, and it was thick enough to stop regular-ish solid shot from your average cannon, which was still, you know, a fairly common weapon in the American Civil War. So it did have a degree of protective value. Conversely, if you were in the Age of Sail, well, you could be raked from fore or aft. If you were raked forward, you already had the full thickness of the hull there on the bow, and that didn't really protect you. All it did, if you're being raked at close range, was create a whole bunch of wooden splinters, which would also travel most of the length of the ship, in addition to the cannon shot. And so when you were looking at being raked from the stern, it was a case of, well, if we get raked from the stern, I mean, it's going to be bad, but if we leave it as is, there'll be maybe some glass, if we leave the glass there in the stern windows, and the cannon shot. And if we build a big thick bulkhead, well, at that point you're only going to be able to do it out of wood, at which point you're going to have the same problems if you were raked from the bow, in that you now have the same iron shot coming through, just with a bunch of high velocity wood as well, which isn't particularly great. And so for the most part, there weren't bulkheads in Age of Sail ships. There were a few ships where you could perhaps argue there was a form of light bulkhead which may have protected against something like, say, musketry, or maybe at a stretch, grape or canister shot, at least the smaller variants thereof, but still would offer zero protective value against both heavy grape shot and more regular large iron shot. But those examples are very few and far between. Craig Hornick asks, did Ryan tease you about New Jersey getting their Mikasa videos out before yours? Well, I'm very happy to report that as we're all good friends, both Ryan and Libby have thoroughly embraced the somewhat British idea of make sure you tease and insult your friends on a semi-regular basis. I don't know if other cultures have that as well, because it shows that you are friends, because you know that there's no actual malice behind it, so it's quite fun. So yes, there was a little bit of banter around the fact that Ryan got to see Mikasa after I did, but got the videos out before I did. But at the same time, of course, as a sort of a response salvo, there's the fact, as I pointed out to him, that I managed to finish the battleship, visit all the museum battleships first, because although I got my Mikasa video came out later, both of us had, up until last year, visited 8 of the 9 preserved battleships, because, well, they're all in the US, that being obviously the 4 Iowas, the 2 South Dakotas, North Carolina, and Texas. Mikasa was the last one on both our lists, but I got to Mikasa first. So I completed the set first, even though if I didn't do the video first. And that, of course, sparked this whole other discussion about whether you count Victory as a battleship or as an Age of Sail vessel. Because if you count Victory as a battleship, then there are 10 preserved battleships, and I've visited all of them, and Ryan would still be short one. So, of course, naturally, Ryan's position is that Victory doesn't count, and we are only talking about the steel ones. Which is fair, because at that point, that would open things up to include things like Warrior and Mary Rose, and then the numbers go up and up and up, and, well, I'd still have visited all of them. Warrant Officer Will asks, did anyone ever flirt with the idea of using triple gun turrets on pre-dreadnoughts? I know that triple and even quadruple turrets had been thought up as far back as the Ironclad era, but did anyone actually try to use them on pre-dreadnought battleships? There was the occasional proposal to try and heavily upgun a pre-dreadnought battleship by having a triple turret, or in some cases the argument went that, well, if we have a triple turret up front, then that gives us more guns firing forward than we'd normally do, and then we can have either a single turret or no turret aft. There was that whole trend for all forward gun ships at one point in the very late Ironclad, very early pre-dreadnought era. But it founded on two rather important principles. Firstly, while the idea was certainly there, at a battleship scale, no one actually built a working triple turret until the 1900s, which obviously for the pre-dreadnoughts was a bit of a problem, because you might have the idea, but if no one's actually got something that you can install, there's extra issues. And of course, the cost of developing such a thing, if you wanted to go with it, would therefore be quite high. The other problem was just footprint. So if you look at top-down plans of pre-dreadnoughts, or indeed you visit something like Mikasa, you'll notice that although proportionally the amount of deck space width-wise taken up by the twin turrets that you find on most pre-dreadnoughts is similar to the amount taken up by the various turrets on most dreadnoughts, that is proportional, because the pre-dreadnoughts are also considerably smaller vessels. And so the available space is physically actually a lot less. And that's quite important, because on a battleship like, say, a typical World War I era battleship, you're looking at a beam of usually somewhere in the mid-80s going up to the low to mid-90s of feet, whereas the average pre-dreadnought is somewhere in the mid-70s of feet in beam. So even a smaller World War I era dreadnought has 10 foot of beam on a pre-dreadnought, and some of the larger ones have 20 to 25 foot of beam on them. And that simply means that there just isn't physically the hull space to install a triple turret on your typical pre-dreadnought, because that, you know, we're talking about maximum beam width here. The hull, obviously, when you get down to things like the magazine, starts to narrow down. You've got to have the barbette armor and so forth. And so sticking a triple turret on, you'd just end up with the entire turret complex basically going almost complete side to side on a pre-dreadnought, and that is both unsafe and unstable for all sorts of reasons. Baxter asks, during Operation Pedestal, a group of Italian torpedo bombers dropped torpedoes at HMS Rodney. The captain ordered her main battery to fire at the torpedoes and cause them to detonate prematurely. If this worked so effectively, why wouldn't this be adopted by every other nation? It's mentioned in the Operations Room video on Operation Pedestal Part 2 at around 5 minutes 24 seconds. So the principle of a splash barrage, which is what Rodney and Nelson were trying to achieve, was relatively well known across the naval world, and indeed in other cases when capital ships came under attack by torpedo bombers, they also tried to pull this kind of thing off with varying levels of success. So, for example, Bismarck is known to have used a splash barrage using her main guns on at least some of the Swordfish raids that came in on her. Obviously, that didn't help very much. Scharnhorst and Gneisenau used the same tactic again against Swordfish coming in at them after during the Channel Dash. In that case, it again wasn't quite as successful, but sort of was at the same time. So the splash barrage itself wasn't particularly effective against Swordfish. The Swordfish were mostly shot down by anti-aircraft gunfire and German fighters. However, there are some reports from that particular incident that one of the Swordfish was pretty much cut in half by a stray 11-inch shell that very clearly wasn't going to hit and cause a splash barrage, but instead, by sheer luck, managed to connect with the Swordfish physically. So there you go. And obviously, various other navies would do it as well. And the idea of the splash barrage most of the time wasn't actually to go after the torpedoes, it was to disrupt the torpedo attacks. The theory went that, well, one, big visual, barrier, so the torpedo bombers would find it difficult to draw a bead on their target. Two, with that amount of water in the air, a torpedo bomber that's flying low to the ground, really doesn't want to fly through that, because there's a good chance that the water will just flat out do enough damage to break the aircraft and cause it to crash. And two, even if it somehow doesn't, the either upwelling of water, if the torpedo bomber flies through during the initial part of the explosion, might flip or otherwise force the torpedo bomber up and out off course. And if it's later, then the falling water might drag the torpedo bomber down into the sea, or the amount of water ingested into the engine might cause the engine to choke. So basically, you didn't want to fly through the thing, so you'd have to go around it. And if you went around it, then you would break up your attack run. So this was the general objective. In terms of using them specifically against incoming torpedoes, this was a tactic that was obviously something of a tactic of desperation. It was used with varying degrees of naval artillery, so small guns as well as large, in some emergency situations, but it was something that was actually far more difficult to pull off, which is why it wasn't adopted as a standard tactic. Because it wasn't something that you could really ask a fire control system to do. Some torpedoes might be traveling slow enough that you could theoretically register them as targets, but good luck getting a range finder fix on them. So you would essentially be almost bore sighting the guns in, most likely just the turret commanders using their own range finders for it. And because of obviously the speed of the torpedoes and the distance involved, you'd essentially have to already be looking in that direction with the guns loaded or very soon to be reloaded, which obviously is what they were doing, firing at the incoming aircraft. And so the actual window in which you could theoretically pull this off, plus the circumstances where you could get the gun turret around in the first place, because even with if you have the window, if the gun turret's pointing the wrong direction, it's going to take too long to bring it around and depress the guns, etc. And you have to have HE shells loaded for it to be truly effective. The sheer combination of factors means that while most captains would theoretically be aware that it was a possibility, in practice they'd be far more worried about physically just evading the torpedoes. So I think in this particular case, because I have read about the use of the splash barrage by both Rodney and Nelson before in context of Pedestal, I think what was happening was that they're not so much aiming at the torpedoes, they're aiming at disrupting the torpedo bomber attack. And then when that, to a certain extent, fails, because, hey, the Italians do drop a bunch of torpedoes at them, it's a case of, well, we've got the guns aimed in that direction anyway, and because they're locked in a convoy, evasive action isn't so available as it would be in a more normal open action. at which point they're just going, well, you know what, we might as well chance it. And it just so happens in this particular case to have worked for them. TZ8785 asks, did any Navy consider or seriously experiment with howitzer-style main guns in capital ships? If you're doing high-angle fire, plunging fire could then come in quite steeply. There were howitzers that were used for shore bombardment, particularly in the Age of Sail, but in terms of being the main guns in capital ships, no, they weren't really ever seriously considered, at least in the Age of Steam and Steel. And that's for a few different reasons. Firstly, of course, if you're going to fire a howitzer, a big 12, 13-inch howitzer, you need considerable reinforcement to deal with the vertical forces, whereas for more conventional guns, it's more about horizontal forces, which are much easier to compensate for because you've got a lot greater travel distance. But also, the accuracy of these weapons would be basically almost minimal in the pre-dreadnought and early dreadnought period, and essentially completely ineffective in the later dreadnought period. So in the later dreadnought period, because of course howitzers have to fire their shells in big high arcs, they have a much more limited range compared to a long barrel naval artillery piece that's firing at 20, 30, 40 degrees, and most of them are 20 to 30 degrees. So, you know, getting a howitzer that can fire 25,000 yards, it's just not really going to be a thing. You'd need an absurdly large howitzer to do so. So, for example, the 12-inch railway-mounted howitzers that the British used in World War One, even in their very last and most powerful iterations, only had a maximum range of about 15,000 yards. Whereas a contemporary British 12-inch naval artillery gun could reach well over 20,000 yards with a fairly small elevation of around about 15 degrees. And then on top of that, as I said, accuracy, even in earlier ships where main gun ranges would be low enough that perhaps a howitzer might be able to match them, accuracy is still going to be terrible because the howitzer, firing in a big high arc, has a much longer time of flight for the shell, and thus a much longer time for things to change. I mean, it's going to be going up through perhaps more layers of the atmosphere as well. So an enemy taking evasive action, for example, has a lot longer to do so. And for your fire control prediction, you've got to predict a lot further into the future to land the shell properly. And there's also what comes by various different names, but we'll call it target shadow, essentially. So if you're firing a shell from a conventional naval gun at a relatively low angle, if you consider the profile of the ship, the length of the target that you're firing at. Now, if your calculations are accurate, and because bear in mind, you're actually technically firing a spot on the sea that just happens to be occupied by the ship. If you're calculations are completely accurate, great, you will land a shell, you know, fairly low near the waterline of your target. But if your range calculations are slightly off and actually your shell would have landed, I don't know, 50 yards past the target, well, because the target does have a height element to it, then a shell that's coming in at 10, 15 degrees might still strike the target. It'll just strike either higher up on the hull or potentially in the superstructure. And so you have this shadow effect where if you imagine a shadow cast by the ship from a light source that's at the same angle and same height as the incoming shell, then, as I said, your range calculations can be off, i.e. over, by the amount encapsulated by that shadow, and you'll still get a hit. If you have plunging fire, really high angle plunging fire from a howitzer, assuming it's even going to arrive there in the first place, if you imagine putting a light up there, the shadow cast is a lot less, which means that actually the area in which your calculations will give you a hit is also less. So even if we ignored all the flight time implications, the howitzer is still going to hit far less often. And so, yeah, people didn't really go for it. The only real use you see of howitzers in, well, capital ships or any ships in the early part of the 20th century is like this, which is why it's been on here the entire time, which was for anti-submarine use, because being relatively short barrel weapons, obviously they had less recoil, so you could mount them in kind of open mounts in all sorts of places on ships. But even this was relatively quickly replaced by depth charge launchers. Charles CDT asks, since you did this quick video for December 7th, that being where the US fleet was on December 7th, do you have any plans on doing one for the destroyers and cruisers? Maybe, but definitely not in exactly the way that I did for the carriers and the battleships, because, of course, there were few enough battleships and carriers that on a world map scale, you could actually indicate them all without it getting ridiculously crowded. And even then, as you probably saw for the Atlantic-based ships, it did get a little crowded at times. Plus, it would also get somewhat boring, you know, especially when you get to destroyers. We're like, well, this ship was here, and this ship was also here, and so was this ship, and so was this ship, and this ship was also here, and this ship also happened to be here, because there's a lot of them. Now, what I potentially could do instead would be to do it by units, so destroyer divisions, submarine squadrons, or destroyer squadrons and cruiser squadrons and so forth. So it'd be like, okay, destroyer squadron 14 was based here. Submarine squadron 6 was based here. Also, of course, then I can use, you know, Desron, Subron, etc. abbreviations, which make things a lot easier. And depending on just exactly how many of units that covers, I might also then be able to say, well, you know, cruiser squadron 4 consisting of blah, 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 and blah was here. That might be a workable format, but I'd have to work on exactly how it was done. Dr. D.M. Platt asks, early World War II US Navy battle stations versus duty stations. While some roles like anti-aircraft ammunition passer and stores clerk make sense, something akin to steering monitor motor and fire control assistant as a pairing of battle versus duty stations does not. Why did the US Navy have such wacky pairings? Cross-training is important to have backups to your backups, but in the area where battle is not unlikely. In the early part of the war, there was quite a bit of left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing when it came to the split of battle stations versus duty stations in the US Navy. I don't know for certain, but I have a suspicion that what was going on was obviously people have their duty stations, which is what their regular area of expertise would be in. And then you would have people devising, okay, well, we now need to work out where their battle stations are going to be. Now, some battle stations are fairly obvious. You know, if you're a stoker or an engineer, which is going to be your duty station because the ship needs to move even when people aren't shooting at it, it makes sense to keep you in that position when people are shooting at you because, well, you're the people who know how to run the engines. But when you extend much beyond the more obvious, what seems to have happened is someone looking at a list of crew, looking at a list of their theoretical qualifications, and just going, okay, this person here, this person here, this person here, this person here, without any particular reference to where their duty station actually was. And so you might end up with, let's say, a block of 20 people who notionally have some capability as anti-aircraft gunners, let's say. Well, at that point, it seems that the assignment went, okay, well, the first, let's say, 5 people from this block, their battle station can be this portside forward anti-aircraft installation. And then the next 5 people, they get the starboard forward, the next 5 people aft port, next 5 people aft starboard. But the fact that those, let's say, of the first 10 people who are going to the forward anti-aircraft installations, the fact that their duty stations might be somewhere in the aft portion of the ship 3 decks down, and therefore they've got to run almost the entire length of the ship, and a good chunk of the people who are assigned to the aft anti-aircraft platforms might have regular duty stations somewhere up near the paint lockers or something in the bow, and therefore it would make more sense to switch those people around. It seems that the connect of where these people are on their duty stations versus where you want them to be at their battle stations just wasn't made. Two different departments that didn't talk to each other very much were setting these various locations. And the US Navy suffered for it. So that's why I've got this picture of Quincy at the Battle of Sabo Island, because one of the reasons why the US cruisers took so long to get to their battle stations as compared to Canberra, which was within a few seconds of being able to open fire, was the fact that there was this mass confusion of, you know, okay, battle stations, but now you've got half the crew at the aft end of the ship trying to get forward and half the crew at the forward end of the ship trying to get aft. And quite apart from whether or not everyone remembers, you know, which corridors and which ladders are up or down or fore or aft in that confusion, the simple fact is a good chunk of the ship's crew were trying to get to the other end of the ship, and that just takes time, especially on a ship the size of a cruiser. Although, fortunately for the US Navy, they did seem to recognise this fairly quickly in the midst of the debacle at Guadalcanal and change things so that your duty station and your battle station were at least somewhat in proximity to each other. Alternate historian Turtle Duck asks, HMS Dreadnought was built in only a year. How was the Royal Navy able to achieve this feat, and why didn't they continue doing this? It seems to me that doing what they did for Dreadnought for the later generations of battleships would have allowed the Royal Navy to win the naval arms race against the Germans even sooner. Basically, Fisher engineered a situation where he was running the Royal Navy's building capacity to the absolute maximum. So the first thing he did was he looked around and went, which dockyard historically turns out its ships the fastest? That turned out to be, at the time, the Royal Dockyard in Portsmouth. So he said, right, Dreadnought's going to be built there. The next thing he did was a combination of pre-planning and just outright stealing. So, of course, the keel laying of the ship is the start gun on the construction, but you have long lead items like armour, guns, and various other bits of material. So, as well as ordering the long lead items as was necessary, Fisher realised that if he was going to meet his target laydown date and then completion date, it was actually already too late to order the guns. So he just said, okay, well, we're using the same gun systems as those on Lord Nelson and Agamemnon. So guess what? We've already ordered those guns. We're diverting some of those guns to Dreadnought, which is why Lord Nelson and Agamemnon ended up actually finishing later than Dreadnought. Next, obviously, you have to start ordering in materials, general materials, you know, beams and plates and so forth. And that was done, but then what Fisher did was not just order in, okay, we're going to order in the first month's worth of materials, and then we'll order the next month and the next month and the next month on a rolling basis. He ordered about half the ship to be assembled, as in the materials stockpiled, in Portsmouth Dockyard well ahead of time, so that there wouldn't be, you know, a few days here and there where something was needed and it wasn't available. And once all that material started piling up, a good chunk of it was laid out in a position that once the start gun was fired, they'd be able to not just start working on the ship itself in on the slipway, but also, because the other material is right there, other men could start to pre-assemble sections. So rather than, say, bringing in a beam, and then that needs to be joined to three other beams to make a complete beam, they just went, okay, well, the crane that's bringing that beam in can bring in the entire beam. It's just that the beam is manufactured in several sections for ease of transport or whatever. Well, how about we get some men to actually pre-assemble that beam off to one side? So then when we bring it in, we just bring in the whole thing, slot it in, rivet it in, job's a good one, and that saves an awful lot of time on the construction of the ship, rather than having to bring in three separate beams and do three separate sets of riveting. So in a way, kind of a prefabrication effort. Also, the number of men on that particular project was dramatically increased from the normal number of men who'd be assigned to it. And everybody was working 6-day weeks, 6 a.m. to 6 p.m., rather than the standard 48-hour or so-ish week that people would normally work. So you had more men essentially working long shifts and or later separate double shifts. So it was a throw everything and the kitchen sink effort, which obviously involved a fair bit of planning, which, okay, could be replicated for other ship builds, but also used a fair amount more money. Because obviously if you've got three times as many men working on the ship, you have to pay three times as many people. And if you've got those people working, you know, 50% longer, then you're having to pay them 50% more, or still more if obviously overtime rates are higher. Now, of course, there is some offset if you only paying this exorbitantly high rate of manpower for a year as opposed to two, then, you know, that's going to reduce the complete overhead by a certain amount. But unfortunately, even in 1905, you had to consider the treasury. So while the manpower costs actually turned out to, roughly speaking, even themselves out, and the build cost of Dreadnought and the subsequent Bellerophons as an absolute figure turned out to be about the same, a little bit over £1.7 million, the fact was for Dreadnought, you'd spent that £1.7 million in a single year, admittedly, because it was laid down in October. It was split across two financial years, but essentially within approximately 12 calendar months, you'd spent just over £1.7 million. Whereas with a Bellerophon class, even if you spent exactly the same amount of money, you were spreading it out over 24, 26 calendar months. And thus, the monthly outgoings to construct the ship would be about half as much. And the Treasury likes those kinds of things because they just look at the initial figures and go, oh, look, we're spending less money. Because they're idiots. But essentially, it comes down to very few dockyards could repeat what Dreadnought had done. And while in theory you could potentially work out a system whereby at Portsmouth Dockyard at least could be kicking out a battleship a year, that would mean that the Portsmouth Dockyard would be either sitting idle half the time while it waited for everybody else to catch up, or the dockyard would be building two battleships to every one that everyone else was building, which would then mean that private contractors would start to cry because, well, if you're building a four-ship class and two of them are just going to Portsmouth Dockyard and you have to give at least one to one of the other Royal Dockyards to keep them in business, well, now there's only one available for the private dockyards, and then obviously they're going to be worried about their ongoing business capabilities. And the only point in all of this where the Treasury might actually have a point is that, you know, if you do spend the entire budget to build a battleship in a year instead of two, and thus you can build a second set of battleships the next year, then after 2 years, you will actually have spent twice as much money because you've built twice as many ships and those costs aren't reducing. And that means the naval budget would have to, well, not double because the naval budget includes all sorts of other things like maintenance and building other ships, but there would be a significant increase in the amount demanded in each year's Navy estimates, which could be difficult to justify. Either that, or you'd be doing a year on, year off, at which point your build rate is basically the same. Maximus Tillman IV asks, suppose Japan goes all in on naval aviation and aircraft carriers, using the steel and shipyards to make another five or six carriers instead of the Yamatos. How does the Pacific War develop? Well, one thing you've got to bear in mind is that for Japan, it's not just a case of, oh, we've got, you know, 65 plus thousand tons of Yamato class, so that neatly divides into, you know, two Shikaku or three Hiryu size carriers. It's also about shipyard space. The Japanese only have a limited amount of slipways that are large enough to accommodate carriers. Now, with that said, there's a couple of options. In terms of the question, there's no real way for the Japanese to have five or six carriers ready for December 7th, 1941. However, it is possible if you take Yamato and Musashi and Shinano out of the construction rota, and Shinano's sister ship, which goes on the same slipway as Yamato in Kure, once Yamato's out of there, obviously. And if you move Junyo over to Kure as well and move Minishin around, you could potentially, after the historical building program that now doesn't include the Yamatos, have four slipways capable of taking carriers. Now, from that, you face another decision, which is that obviously time on slipway does not mean time to commission. You launch the ship, then you've got to fit out the ship, and then you've got to actually commission the vessel. Now, if you're going for an ideal carrier force on December 7th, 1941, then essentially what you want to do is build four repeat Shikakus. And you could just about get those in service. You'd only get three in service. The one that would go on in Yokosuka after Shikaku herself, it'd be a bit questionable whether she'd be ready in time, but maybe. Especially if you have an expedited fitting out and commissioning period. Now, it might be tempted to go with the Kai Hiryu type instead, because that will take a little bit less time to build, but will obviously give you a less capable carrier. But at that point, it's perhaps more likely that you'll have four additional carriers ready for December 7th. And critically, obviously, if you do that, then you might have another at least three, the fourth, well, let's say 5 to 7 and the 8th not. If you're building Kai Hiryu types, you might just about have another three ready to go in 42. And then maybe the last one in late 42, early 43. So that'll give you 8 additional hulls. Conversely, if you go with Shikaku's and then Kai Hiryu's, then you're going to be looking at those carriers coming into commission a bit later, sort of late 42, early 43, the second wave. But in a realistic, optimistic scenario for maximum power in the early part of the war, let's say we're going with 4 Shikaku's and the one in Yokosuka has been significantly expedited. So we've got 4 extra Shikaku's, fantastic. So that means we've got 10 fleet carriers plus all the various smaller ancillary stuff that the Japanese Navy is converting and building. And assuming they expand their naval pilot training program to compensate, there are 2 big questions that hang over this. Firstly, what is the response of the US and the UK? Because historically, they knew that the Japanese were building battleships. They just didn't know exactly what scale the Yamatos were. And obviously, both Britain and America had plans to build lots of battleships themselves, so they weren't too concerned about that. However, if they know that the Japanese are instead building carriers, that may then affect how the British, and more importantly for the early part of the Pacific War, the Americans, order their own carrier program. And obviously, if the Americans, I don't know, order a bunch of additional Hornet, so modified Yorktown-style carriers, for example, and start those as a massive tranche of construction a year or two before the historic Essex-class production line begins, that obviously is going to significantly affect the overall outcome of the war. But, you know, that's a whole video to itself. But assuming for the sake of simplicity that that doesn't happen, the Japanese are pretty much going to roll all the battles in 1942, because, of course, Coral Sea ends with Lexington sunk, and that's just Shikaku and Zuikaku. If you've got 4 additional carriers, then the Japanese can easily afford to send 4 carriers to Coral Sea and still have 2 spare compared to what they had historically. And with the greatest will in the world, 4 Shikakus is not a force that Lexington and Yorktown can stop. But then would the Americans try to stop them if they knew that there were 4 fleet carriers involved? You know, take that as you will, but assume for whatever reason they do. And then, obviously, you get to Midway. Well, at that point, again, you can put at least 2, possibly 4 more carrier hulls in there. So even if Midway goes as ridiculously well as it does for the Americans early on, you've still got 2 to 4 full flight decks worth of aircraft that can come back and strike at Yorktown, Hornet, and Enterprise. And then, of course, each of these battles, assuming that Yorktown wasn't sunk at Coral Sea, of course, if Yorktown was, then it's going to be, you know, 6 to 8 Japanese carriers versus 2 American. And then Guadalcanal gets even worse. So the Japanese will have Henderson Field. They'll have their ring around the Pacific. The first part of the war pretty much goes exactly as the Japanese want it to, assuming, as we said, that the Americans don't counter with their own expanded carrier program. But then, while the Japanese have a much larger fleet to overcome, and it will take longer, the simple fact is that even with the next 4 set of carriers coming online, that gives the Japanese, assuming they don't lose any fleet carriers in these engagements, 14 fleet carriers. And even if the Americans somehow manage to lose every single one of their pre-war carriers in various engagements, which, you know, probably isn't going to happen because they're not stupid, they're not going to engage in massively overwhelming odds against them. But even if that happens, and even if there isn't a kind of Hornet class build-up before the Essex class program, the simple fact is that interdependent carriers, let alone the number that were actually ordered, the Americans still end up building 24 Essex class, with more on the way. So the Americans will inevitably win, simply just because they can outbuild the Japanese and therefore outnumber them. It's just going to take longer, and who knows, potentially we might see the first use of nukes being in an at-sea fleet battle. Dave Collier asks, what is the etymology of the word admiral, and who was the first recorded person to hold that title? So there's two slightly competing views for the original origin of the word admiral, and that both of them are actually Arabic from the Islamic expansions, later defined in some sources as Ottoman, but of course in the 900s and 1000s, they're not Ottoman, they're generic, if such a term can be applied, generic Islamic factions in the Middle East. But in any case, you have a title which is Amir, also nowadays a name, I believe, many people, sometimes later on Emir, spelled E-M-I-R, but at the time Amir, A-M-I-R, which means prince, commander, leader. Basically, it implies authority, usually royal, but not necessarily, over a large group of people. Then you have the definitive article, which in Arabic is al. So, and in this particular word form, it comes after the word that you're putting the definite article on, which is different to, so let's say, Greek, where you would have it at the beginning. So you'd have the, which is al, the definite article. In Arabic, in Greek, it would be ho, H-O with a little accent marker over it. But that comes before. And obviously in English, it's the. And obviously, again, it becomes before the thing. So whereas in English, we would say the leader or the commander or the prince. And in Greek, you'd say ho principas, the prince, or whatever the Greek term for commander is, etc. The reason I'm using Greek is, of course, they're the immediately adjacent neighbours to the Islamic expansion for the most part. So it gives kind of a contrast between the language practices. But in Arabic, it's amiral. And then you'd have some kind of suffix which tells you what you are the commander or the prince of. And that's where there's the little bit of disagreement. You know, I think it's umara, which amir al-umara, which would be the chief of all the things. Or is it amir al-bahar? I think that's how it's pronounced, which is Prince of the Seas. And that is a formal title in the early Islamic world, which is actually chief of the navy. In English, Old English at the time, the title is Keeper of the Seas and Keeper of the Ports. So everyone kind of has their version of what will eventually become the admiral title. And it's usually either commander, keeper, chief, prince, etc. of the seas. In some ways, weirdly enough, a bit like how in the Commonwealth or Republican period of England later on, they ditch the title of admiral and go with general at sea, which is very similar. But in the 1200s, this term from Arabic starts to make its way across the Mediterranean, and they lose the latter part, whatever it happened to be, and they just have amir al, which gets put together into amiral. And so when you look at a lot of the more Mediterranean countries, then areas where those languages are spoken elsewhere, the term that obviously in English is admiral these days tends to be either just straight up amiral, like in French, for example, or has something added a little bit to the end because of linguistic differences, like in the Italian. As it drifts further west into Spanish and Portuguese territories, and therefore, obviously, people who speak those languages, like in South America, the L seems to migrate to the beginning. So you get Almiran, Almira, and then obviously you get additional bits stuck on the end, again, for linguistic differences, so you get Almirante. And as it drifts further north, then, and eventually obviously getting to English, the L doesn't drift, but you get an additional D for various reasons, which I believe is something to do with some forms of Latin. So amiral goes to admiral, admiral, and there you have admiral. The rank essentially just means, you know, dude who is in charge of the sea. which is presumably why admirals, when they meet up on opposite sides, tend to fight, because there can only be one. In terms of the first person recorded to hold that particular title, it's incredibly variable, unfortunately. You know, I can point you to the first person in the UK, or in England at the time, who held the title of admiral, but of course, different people at different points in different countries, as the term comes into vogue, will have held that title, and it takes a while for the title to get up to England, given that it's originally of a Mediterranean origin. And then, of course, you have the whole argument of, well, is someone called Amir al-Bahar in Arabic, even though it's not a single conjugate title, but it's pronounced essentially the same way, is one of those actually the first admiral? Take your pick. Which one do you want? And I'll try and work out which one has the first version of that particular title. Texas and La Choc asks, one of the things Gilbert and Sullivan satirise in HMS Pinafore is the Royal Navy's polite orders. How did this come about, and how prevalent was it among other navies, if you please? It has an awful lot to do with the origins of the Royal Navy in particular, but also more generally most, at least European navies, in that to hold a significant command of, at that point, the Royal Warships, wherever you happen to be, it was as much about your social status or on land, i.e. how far up the aristocracy you were, as it was about any ability to actually command at sea, which is why you get the kind of the differentiation between the captain or the admiral and the ship's master, because it may very well be that the captain or admiral or commodore or whatever rank of noble has been stuck on the ship, they may very well have the social cachet to be the person in command. They may have zero idea about how to actually command a ship. And that's what the ship's master is for. The noble says, I want to go over there. That is about the furthest extent of potentially that particular noble's seagoing knowledge. It's not always the case. Some nobles actually do have a clue what's going on. But in the sort of the lowest common denominator case, I want to go over there is then the job of the ship's master to translate into, okay, well, we have to put the sails in this way, we have to put the rudder over this way, and also the wind's going that way, so maybe we can't go quite over there just now, etc., etc. And because of that, and that's obviously just whoever's in charge of the ship, but various of the immediately lower-ranking officers also will tend to be from some form of aristocracy. And therefore, not only are they carrying their own method of speaking and etiquette over, there is a certain amount of social airs and graces that are expected while you're aboard a ship. A gentleman must always be polite. And especially if a lot of the other people you're speaking to, at least among your senior staff, are also aristocracy of some description, they are going, or at least gentry, they're going to expect you to be polite to them. And equally, you are going to expect them to be polite to you. And especially if you are the captain, and therefore, as we said, if we're talking about 13, 14, 15, 1600s, probably some kind of lord or baron or whatever, you're going to expect deference from the common folk, the sailors, and if you like, the NCOs. And they also are going to be very aware that the social strictures of the time expect you to be polite. And so you get this whole system where everybody is being very polite to each other, unless and until somebody loses their temper, simply because that's what the social structure on land demands, and a lot of that has now been imported at sea, and it's perhaps somewhat more concentrated, because on land, there might be the lord of the manor, or the lord of that castle, or the duke of this or that, but proportionally they are very, very much outnumbered by the general folk, and the amount of interaction you're going to have between them is relatively limited. So between the regular people, the majority of the population, they're going to just talk as normal. But on a ship, you have multiple representatives of the gentry or the nobility, and proportionally speaking, not only are you coming into contact with them a lot more, but there's a lot more of them proportionally aboard a ship compared to the regular crew than there would be on land. and therefore the social strictures get even more rigid and even more expected. And thus the entire system of, you know, if you please, I'm pleased to report, sends his greetings, etc., appended to pretty much almost every bit of conversation, at least formally, starts to arise. And it's relatively common in other navies, but exactly how common it is in each individual navy very much depends on, again, the reflection of the social standings and the expected interactions ashore in those various countries. Because obviously in some countries, like, say, England, in ideal circumstances, not that this was always the case, but the social expectation was that if generic person A says, oh yes, by your leave, my lord, I would like to report this, thank you very much, then it is expected that the noble will respond in kind, politely. In some other areas of Europe, where the peasantry, the serfs, whatever, are viewed somewhat lower, perhaps, the expectation of the noble or the gentry responding politely isn't actually there as much, if at all. So obviously, again, reflecting in those navies, the structure may not be as firm, or, you know, it'll be in place between the officers, but not in the officer-crew interactions. The crew will still be expected to be polite, but the officers don't necessarily have to be polite in return. Patrick Donnelly asks, given that it's Star Wars month, and therefore May the 4th be with you, the hunt for the separatist battleship Malevolence in Star Wars The Clone Wars is arguably inspired by the hunt for the Bismarck. Do you see any other naval battles from the period the channel covers that inspire or influence the franchise's space battles? There are certain influences, I would definitely say. I mean, it's fairly well known that a lot of the starfighter interactions in the original Star Wars trilogy are actually inspired by gun camera footage of World War II aerial combats, a lot of which are US Navy aerial combats from the Pacific section of World War II. But in terms of big ship slugging matches, in, if you like, the mainstream canon, so the movies, then it's harder to tell because there are not really all that many major engagements. You've got the Battle of Coruscant in Episode 3, for instance, which to a certain degree is almost Trafalgar-like. It's a mad melee that, you know, there's no strict battle lines. Everyone's just wandering around shooting each other at point-blank range. And the reason I've chosen this particular screen cap is, of course, this is quite literally a point-blank broadside engagement, Nelsonian style, between a Venator class and one of the CIS vessels. Of course, being sci-fi, they also have turrets and stuff, but you actually see in this engagement, they also literally have gun decks with, you know, relatively, not entirely, but relatively fixed guns blasting away at each other. There's no major capital ship on capital ship action in Episode 1, 2, 4, or 5. There is, of course, the Battle of Endor in Episode 6, but again, that's more of a close-range pell-mell action forced by the presence of the second Death Star. It's not, strictly speaking, inspired by any other historical action, because, well, there wasn't a historical action where everyone went, hey, let's all get nice and close and personal, because there's a massive super weapon sitting presumably ashore which can one-shot any of our ships, so let's get in amongst the others so that it can't hit us. And certainly in the Clone Wars series, which I think is where you see most of the big ship-to-ship battles, there are certainly various battles which you can see have certainly been inspired by at least tactics from the time period the channel covers. The Battle of Ryloth, for instance, has very, very, very heavy elements of carrier tactics, World War II carrier tactics, and maybe even certain elements of Midway thrown in there, although with quite heavy twists. But I wouldn't say, personally, looking at the various bits of Star Wars media that I've consumed, that outside of the Hunt for the Malevolence, there have been particular storylines or battles where I've gone, oh, that's directly inspired by this. I mean, there's the whole cloak ship thing, which is obviously, you know, submarines except in space, but it's still only loosely tied to that. And that brings us to an end for this week's Dry Dock. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening, and I hope to see you in another video soon. Bye for now.